support comes from.
Well, good evening, and thanks for tuning into Hemispheres. I'm your host, Jim Nelson, and thanks for tuning into listener-sponsored community radio, KGNU Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins, and also at KGNU.org. And this evening on Hemispheres, we continue the Middle East dialogues. Always joining me in those conversations are Ibrahim Kazrouni and Rob Prince. Ibrahim Kazrouni is a regular contributor to the International Press Roundtable. Ibrahim also has a PhD from the joint ILF and Denver University PhD programs within the Religion and Social Change concentration. And Ibrahim Kazrouni is also Imam of the Islamic Center of America, which is in Dearborn, Michigan. So, good evening, Ibrahim.
Yes, good evening, Jim. It's a pleasure to be back. Good evening, Rob, and hello to our listeners and audience.
And, of course, joining us, as always, Rob Prince. He was a senior lecturer of International Studies at the Corbell School at Denver University. Rob is also published in many online magazines such as Foreign Policy and Focus and AlgeriaWatch.org, and he also contributes regularly to the award-winning online publication Nahwat.org, a Tunisian human rights publication. Good evening to you as well, Rob.
Hi, Jim. Hi, Ibrahim, and greetings to the listeners.
Well, good. This evening's topic, then, we'll get right into it, is going to be looking at Middle East policy in regards to the upcoming U.S. election. We're right in the middle of the campaign. And what that Middle East policy might be under the current president, if he were to win another 4 years, and or the Democratic presidential candidate, Joe Biden. So we've had 3+ years of the Trump presidency, and its Middle East policy and its policy in the area. We look at arms sales. There's not a lot other than the arms sales. There hasn't been that much to Saudi Arabia and a couple of other countries. Today, Trump gave a 7-minute speech, which many are wondering, to the UN General Assembly, that 7-minute speech. Many have said that in the reports I've seen, it might be the shortest speech ever by a leader of any country. So he's always finding...
I've heard that, Jim, with Castro.
Well, there you go, right, who had maybe the longest. And then the...
Castro, when he spoke to the General Assembly, there was substance in it.
Oh, for sure.
He analyzed international relation. He analyzed the state of the power in engagement, et cetera,
sure,
et cetera. And this guy gives 7 minutes, and hardly anybody around. They all walked out.
Well, and it was online and pre-recorded, as many of the other speeches were today. And the speech, of course, was filled with inaccuracies and a lot of hyperbole, even in 7 minutes. And... In the Middle East, he mentioned, of course, he highlighted the Trump termed the peace deals with the UAE, Bahrain, and Israel. These, of course, are not peace deals. They're just deals of where, you know, they're opening up embassies and so forth, but not in the sense of peace, because they weren't at war. And anyway, also, he... mentioned how he eliminated ISIS, which is also inaccurate.
Good Lord.
There are many thousands of ISIS members. The caliphate itself is gone, or the area that they occupied is gone, but many of the ISIS members are gone. And he also highlighted the military buildup that he had of weapons, so advanced the world has never seen any of these weapons that he's developed, and the world will be amazed, I guess, once we see them. Okay. Hopefully we never see them. And then Trump ended the speech. This is something he's been doing for a while. I think he might say it at every UN speech. It's the all countries, you know, it's America first policy, and all countries in the UN should do the same. And I do have to look at, I'm not really sure. One of the things I mentioned to Rob earlier, I'm not really sure. I know what it means, but it's also very interesting when you look at it in context of, you know, we're going it alone. And then, and he's ripped up this agreement with, you know, the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal, but yet he wants to impose the sanctions from that very deal that he got rid of. So I don't really know what the heck this gentleman really ever talks about, but he gave that speech to the UN today, and so I'll let you guys go from there and talk about foreign policy in the Middle East. Who's going first? You, Rob, or?
Yeah, I'll start off. First, let me ask you, Jim, how's the volume here? I just want to check the technical part of it.
Yeah,
you
it's okay.
Am I okay?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah,
all right,
you're fine.
All right. So, just a few words about the speech. So, Ibrahim was contrasting Trump's speech today with the speeches that Castro used to make. There's another comparison contrast that is applicable here, and that's the contrast between the speech that Trump made and the speech that Vladimir Putin made today. And you'll see some of the same themes in terms of what Castro did in Putin's speech. So for those of you that it's almost become a national sport to attack or even bash Putin, I suggest that you listen to Trump's speech and Putin's speech and draw your own conclusions. Having said that, it wasn't just the shortest speech. Maybe it was, who knows? But it was a terrible speech. It was a vindictive speech. It was the opposite of what's needed today in the world. I mean, at a time when beyond the pandemic that we're facing, the coronavirus pandemic, there's all kinds of issues that are going to require international cooperation, climate change, the new buildup of nuclear weapons, and the idea that the United States or any country can go it alone or, quote, go first is ludicrous in today's world. It's almost like the world is going in one direction, and Trump and those behind him in this country are going in another. So enough of that, though. Here we are, 6 weeks from the election. It's getting pretty close here. According to an ABC News poll a few days ago, no, not ABC, I'm sorry, an NBC Wall Street Journal poll, Biden was ahead by 8 points nationally. Let's all remember how off the polls were in 2016, and that there's a lot of work that needs to be done in this coming period, and we shouldn't take anything for granted. One of the things that often happens prior to these presidential elections, it was come to be known, and many of the listeners are aware of it, is an October surprise. And there's been a lot of speculation. Will there be an October surprise? Will there be a war in the Middle East? A couple of days ago, Trita Parsi, now working out of the Quincy Institute, that new foundation, he published a piece that Pompeo is preparing for some kind of an attack on Iranian ships. Look, anything is possible. We're sitting here. I'm sitting in Denver. Ibrahim's sitting in Detroit. So there are a lot of dangers, and we want to look at or explore a little bit later in the program what are the possibilities of an October surprise. Will it happen internationally, or maybe it will happen domestically? Over the past years, repeatedly, really, we have argued that, be it a Democratic or a Republican administration, when it comes to Middle East policy, that America is essentially losing the handle. I don't know how else to put it. And that despite the bombast about America's ability to lead the world and dictate policy, actually, that ability is shrinking in the Middle East. And American power is waning. And we'll see examples of this in our discussion. There's a broader question right now. What we're looking for, what are the prospects, given the candidates that we have for president of the United States, what are the prospects for peace, not just in the Middle East, but globally? And what will happen, what do we think will happen? Obviously, we're not real clear on it. If Trump gets reelected, what will happen if Biden wins? And what can we expect in terms of U.S. Middle East policy, continuation or change? There have been a number of developments since we were on the last program in terms of Middle East stuff, some of which Jim has referred to. One is that against the wishes of the United Nations Security Council, against the will of the other members of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the Iran nuclear deal, the United States unilaterally is reintroducing what are called snapback sanctions against Iran. What it looks like is that other than a few countries that Washington can kind of strong arm, that there's very little support for this. And we're seeing, once again, something that until a few years ago, it was rare that the United States would be isolated in such a political campaign. But there's, that's been going on. Jim referred to the signing of the Israel-United Arab Emirates-Bahrain agreement, establishing full diplomatic relations with Washington, D.C. My take on this is... They're trying to blow that up into some big public relations stunt. In fact, that's mostly what it is, from what I could tell. In the end, and again, we talked about this in the last show. Trump, there's nothing new about this. The relations have been, under wraps for decades, quite frankly. Israel has been cooperating with a number of conservative Arab countries, among them Bahrain, where we have a big naval base, and the UAE. And so really more what this is about is simply going public about things that have taken place in the past. The other aspect to it is it's essentially a strategic arrangement, an anti-Iranian coalition. And even at that, it looks as if it's not very strong. There's a lot of opposition to this within the Middle East itself.
Rob, just real quick, yes. The day of the signing, when Bahrain announced it was going to sign on to an agreement, there were even demonstrations in Bahrain. Much of the population is against it.
And it's not a place that's easy to demonstrate in.
Exactly.
Jim,
exactly.
That's the level of anger.
Can I interject here?
Sure.
As far as demonstration in Bahrain, since 2011, demonstration in Bahrain, part of the Arab Spring, has never stopped. However, Western media somehow put it on the back burner. Otherwise, every day there are demonstrations in Bahrain. Every day people are being imprisoned. Every day, youth are being killed. So there is nothing new in Bahrain. This is one of those issues that hopefully after Rob, I will be speaking about. So when you say Bahrain demonstrated, Bahrain has been demonstrating since 2011.
Very good info. And Yep, go ahead. I'm sorry, Rob, I cut in
there. Okay, so I have a number of other points, but the only one I want to make right now is that there is a bill before the incoming Congress here, the authorization for the use of military force. This essentially is the bill that gave the green light to give the president the authority to go to war without much consultation, or if any, with Congress in Afghanistan after 9/11. And there are attempts to add to that resolution, to add amendments. And they've been introduced by Barbara Lee. And one of those amendments that she has introduced is to refuse any funding to the administration that would go towards going to war against Iran. But it doesn't have a lot of support, but it's the kind of thing that hopefully people can get behind. All right. So with all this, what we're seeing is, quite frankly, there are hot spots at the moment all over the Middle East, and that to one degree or another, it seems like the entire region is a hot spot. Ibrahim, let's take a look at these hot spots more closely. Are we talking about three, four, or just is it better off to just say the whole Middle East today is a hot spot?
I tend to agree with the assertion that because of the mess that the United States has created, the entire Middle East is literally in crisis, and call it a hot spot or whatever else. We have a crisis right across the region, from the south to the north. And you can speak about North Africa and the crisis in Libya. You can speak about Turkey, its presence in Syria and Iraq, as well as its relationship with another NATO member, Greece. You can speak about Iraq. You can speak about Iran. You can speak about Yemen, Syria, the Israeli-Palestinian issue, and the list, Bahrain, the list goes on. So the entire region is a hot spot. So we go back to the point that you raised earlier, right at the beginning, that you said we are looking for peace globally, but specifically in the Middle East as a region. It's really very difficult and challenging to be able to find out any of the two candidates or prospective candidates, whatever one calls them, are able or willing to do anything as far as, and I'll explain briefly within the time limitation that we have. To resolve the Iraqi issue, United States has to withdraw from Iraq. Is U.S. under Biden or second term, God forbid, of Trump, any of them are prepared to withdraw from Iraq in the light of the history of these two individuals? Syria, the only way the Russians are pushing for reestablishment of the central government all over the territory and deal being made with Turkey regarding withdrawal of Idlib, etc. So is the United States prepared to let go of its occupation of Syrian land and to stealing of its oil, etc., etc.? I don't believe any of them will be able to do that. So with regard to Iran, the only way we can resolve Iran's case is for the United States to agree that Iran is a de facto, is a present, is a strong country, and there is nothing they can do with it, and start negotiating. With regard to Yemen, the problem that we have, the Americans and the Europeans, but in particular the British and the Americans, arming of the Saudis, that during the past year, 6 years, they have been bombing literally Yemen into the Stone Age. Are they going to stop any of them? With regard to the Israeli-Palestinian issue, anyone has anything, any rabbit to pull out of their hat to resolve this issue? During today's United Nations speech, King Abdullah of Jordan made a comment. He said the only problem, the only way we can resolve this crisis is through two-state solution. I wonder if even two-state solution is possible in the light of what the Israelis have done. So the crisis that we have, it's a regional crisis. And I don't believe today, I think it was yesterday, one of the just trying to figure out who was the person that went to the east, to the corner, what we call it, the eastern Euphrates, and to talk to the Kurds and the Kurdish Iraq as well as Kurd in Syria, trying to James Jeffrey. James Jeffrey. What was the name of the other guy who died that went and supported ISIS and brought the ISIS into Syria and will violate
Ford?
Syrian territory? No,
not
Ford
Robert
was the
Ford.
Ambassador. It was the represented the House. It was the senator that died from Arizona.
McCain, John McCain.
McCain, yes, John McCain.
Yeah.
Now this guy is going, James Jeffrey is going and supporting, asking them to show that they fall under U.S. Influence and literally do the dirty jobs for the U.S. I mean, we haven't learned anything from the crisis in Syria. Now recently, they are trying to put pressure on Hezbollah so that the Hezbollah becomes or listed as international terrorist, etc., etc. So I don't believe there was an article last week when we had the program in the Iranian newspaper, at least, this issue was presented. Any likelihood for any of the candidates, particularly Biden, if he were to be elected, would he return to the nuclear deal and honor the deal, bearing in mind that Obama, his chief during the time when Obama was the president, signed it? Whether Biden is going to accept it or not, most of the answers said no, Biden is not going to do that. So I really, it's mystifying to find out which one of these, in the light of their background and in the light of where they stand vis-a-vis these hot spots, they are prepared to take the bold action. Do you want to say anything, Rob?
Just a couple of comments about two of the hot spots that we haven't spoken about for a while, and that's Yemen and Lebanon. So look at what the U.S. has done in Yemen. First of all, we've armed the Saudis and the UAE in their bombing campaign. It's U.S. weapons that are being used. More important than that, we've given them the green light, really, to conduct this war. It's such a savage war. There are laws which, of course, are being completely ignored in the United States about arming countries that then use U.S. weaponry for war, but they've just been completely ignored.
Rob, there are evidence. It's not just military hardware and green light. You have Blackwater and you have American Marines actually on Yemeni soil, guiding and supporting either UAE troops or the Saudi troops or any fighting against Houthis or on anybody else. So it's direct engagement and involvement in the Yemeni theater.
Yes, and there's other aspects to this too. And one of the main things is it's true that there's a terrible humanitarian crisis in Yemen that's known somewhat in this country as a result of this war and of the blockade that's being instituted. But the fact of the matter is that the Saudis are not winning this war, and in fact they're being repeatedly hurt and hit. The Houthi elements and their allies have manufactured pretty much their own missilery, which has hit Saudi oil fields. It's hit Riyadh. There are Yemeni guerrilla activity that goes into Saudi, where they've captured Saudi soldiers. It's not at all, from the military point of view, the Saudis have been embarrassed once again. And the other thing about this war in Yemen, you know, one has to ask, well, what are the Saudis doing there? You know, why are they conducting this horrible war? And a lot of it has to do with controlling access to the Red Sea, because Yemen on its western border sits on the Red Sea and right at the strait. What's the name of that strait, Ibrahim?
Marum. The Strait of Marum.
Okay. Well, anyhow, there's that tiny little strait there. And that's a strategic port place. It doesn't only control the flow of oil to Asia coming through the Red Sea, but it also gives whoever controls that coast influence on the Horn of Africa, Eritrea and Sudan, and ultimately Ethiopia. So that's what that war is about, and it's going very badly. I wanted to just briefly talk about the situation in Lebanon since the terrible explosion of the ammonium nitrate that had been stored in the Beirut harbor. So as many of you are aware, after that, the Lebanese government was forced to quit, and now there's struggles and haggles over the nature of the new government. Essentially, what the United States is doing, and it's doing it quite frankly in support of Israel, and it's doing it with the help of the Saudis. You want to talk about an Israeli-Saudi project? Is to try to discredit and limit the influence of Hezbollah. And kind of turn back, if you like, the political map of Lebanon. I'm sitting here in Denver, but I really don't think it's going to happen. And the United States has instituted this international campaign to get countries to come out and declare Hezbollah as a terrorist organization. It really hasn't produced much of anything. A couple of Latin American countries themselves with terrible human rights records. I remember Guatemala, Honduras has come out, but American allies in the same way, the European allies, the Germans, the French, even the British. No, the British have come out, but the Germans and the French and the Italians, they haven't bitten on this, and they haven't bitten on this because despite all the bad publicity that Hezbollah gets here in the United States, Hezbollah is a serious political force in Lebanon, and it's a political force.
And even Macron, Rob, even Macron, during the visit to Lebanon in post-crisis of the explosion, the two visits that he had, on both occasions, he asked for a direct meeting with Hezbollah representatives in Parliament. With the exclusion of everybody else. So it will be Macron and representative of Hezbollah only to discuss the issues to do with Lebanon. Clearly understanding the role of Hezbollah as Lebanese.
I just want to jump in, yes, gentlemen. The time is
here, Jim, huh?
The time is 6:31. I want to remind the listeners that this is KGNU 88.5 FM, 1390 AM, Boulder, Denver, and 98.7 in Fort Collins. You're tuned to, we're listening here to Hemispheres, and this is the Middle East Dialogues. I'm your host, Jim Nelson, and always joining me in those discussions are Ibrahim Kazrouni and Rob Prince. Okay, I needed to do that. And go ahead, gentlemen.
All right, yeah, I want to add something to this. Yeah, go on. Ibrahim, go
on. I wanted to ask you, when we were discussing these issues, we were trying to understand, an answer for our question that you posed earlier, searching for peace, particularly in the region, or anybody of these individuals. Can you explain a little bit about the background and the record of these two individuals to see, looking at what we really need to resolve the crisis in the region, it appears far-fetched that any one of them is prepared to take that bold, concrete action that would reduce the hot spots and resolve the crisis. Now, in addition to that, their background and their history of where they stand mm-hmm. politically doesn't say much about that hope and expectation either. Can you shed some light?
Sure. Well, this past week, I can say that Ibrahim and I have been doing is we're in the search for doves, and all that we're coming up with are hawks. All right. And having said that, let's talk a little bit about Biden and Trump, and specifically their visions for the Middle East, those that have them. If you look at Joe Biden's history, Joe Biden has a very long history in the U.S. Senate, history as vice president. Every now and then, there's been a glimmer of something dovish, and a policy that overall is not. So to give the man credit, he did raise questions about the NATO attack on Libya. He did. He was critical of Trump's assassination, Trump's directed assassination of Qasem Soleimani, and he's got a good quote about that. If I can find it, yes, he said Trump tossed a stick of dynamite into the tinderbox, which is true. But having said that, on the main
quickly, did I've heard that Biden was actually against the going after Bin Laden as well. Is that true? Have you heard anything about that?
All right, I'm
or he had
sure
questions
that.
About it. He had questions.
Do you know about that?
I haven't come across it.
Okay. I was wondering.
I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah. But the difference is, that's a good point, and we should, frankly.
I didn't look into it.
He gets the point. What it sounds like to me, he's not real enthusiastic about these targeted assassinations of major Middle East leaders. But beyond that, when you look carefully at the overall strategy and goals of both Biden and Trump, there's very little difference, if any. Control, U.S. control and dominance, despite its growing weakness of Middle East energy sources. Policies meant the whole idea of partitioning countries that we've seen, Condoleezza Rice's vision of, quote, a new Middle East, which is going nowhere. The arming of all these countries. And of course, the biggest thing that stands out is his pretty much thoughtless, unending support for Israel and for its military role in the region, and virtually nothing in terms of resolving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. All right. Now, in the end, Trump's we have a record of Trump as president in the Middle East. Now, look what Trump has tried to claim. Trump has tried to claim, and I have, believe it or not, I have friends who are Trump supporters. And one of the things they'll say is, hey, he hasn't gotten us into a Middle East war. Well, that's not exactly true. If you look at what he's done, it's a terrible record in the region, starting with pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, arming to the teeth anybody who's willing to buy U.S. weapons, his defense of the journalist who they murdered in such a horrible way. So when you look at actually what Trump has done in the region, he hasn't resolved anything. And finally, his biggest failure has been, as they call, the deal of the century. The deal of the century, an attempt to once again impose a political solution on the Palestinians, in which they had no role whatsoever, and essentially a de jure, a legal annexation of the territories. He had to back off from that. So when you look at Donald Trump's record on the Middle East, what's there that's good? He's claimed he's reduced troop size in Syria. That's not true. All he did was reallocate the troops. He's doing something like that in Europe, like this last week. Oh, my gosh, you know, I thought it was at first wonderful news. Trump is taking troops out of Germany. Isn't that good? And then the next day, he's taking them out of Germany. He's putting them into Poland. So when we look at it.
And by the way, Rob, the same thing happens. Yes. With Turkey, he pulling a troop out of Turkey and putting them in Cyprus.
Ibrahim, let me just finish with this one thought.
Okay.
And that is, when it comes to the fundamentals, neither Trump nor Biden offer much hope of moving towards Middle East peace, and that ultimately their policies, when you scratch beneath the surface, taking into consideration some minor differences, they're the same. They're both hawks. They're both hawks. Okay, Ibrahim, what's your thought on
that? Jim raised the question regarding whether he objected to Osama bin Laden. This is a report. Question by a Fox News reporter, former Vice President Joe Biden denied that he had told then-President Barack Obama not to go after Osama bin Laden. In what turned out to be a successful mission to kill 9/11 mastermind, the Republican National Committee immediately called it whatever. But he denies it. He said that he told Obama to make sure that the facts are correct, so the whole operation will be successful. But he certainly did not say that not to go after it. But I want to go back to the point.
There's something else here, Ibrahim. Just one more point on this, in terms of what Biden is doing. Biden has been, for most of his political career, very close to the Clintons on most issues. And so what he's really trying to do here is to distance himself the slightest bit, particularly from Hillary's hawkishness over these last years when she was Secretary of State. Go on, Ibrahim.
Yeah, I want to go back to what you said. Not only the facts on the ground don't support any concrete, bold move from any of these two individuals regarding resolution of the hotspots or regional crisis, their background, as you outlined, the backgrounds of these two individuals do not support a move towards peace, whether it's in Iran or in Iraq or Syria or anything else, Yemen or anything else. Why is so? We have discussed between the two of us. There is something that is called the president's, since Monroe, the doctrine. Can you shed some light here on that?
Well, yes. Again, we tried to kind of develop this some last week, but it deserves our attention again. There's a theme that's very deep in the American experience. It really starts before the Monroe Doctrine. It starts with the first. It starts with Columbus. and it's a kind of what we refer to it today as American exceptionalism. And at the heart of this notion of American exceptionalism is the notion that the United States is somehow, quote, different as a country, that our goals are noble, that whatever we're doing in the world, even the wars that we've been involved in, they're supposedly for a good cause, whether it's, you know, as they claim, bringing democracy or what you like. And it's a kind of missionary approach to other countries. If you probe it a little bit deeper, there's a couple of aspects to it. First of all, we're asking other countries to, quote, be like us, all right? That's the standard. Be like us politically, be like us economically. And in so doing, if they don't want to be like us or they feel that their future it lies in creating another economic or political model, this is considered intolerable. So this notion that we can't be wrong and whatever our approach is the right approach. And if something does happen, if you like, that's some problem, it's, quote, a mistake, that the overall policy is still right. For example, the war in Vietnam. Oh, the war in Vietnam, you know, that wasn't part of an overall strategy of U.S. world domination. No, well, it was just a minor mistake in judgment. And here, by the way, if you look carefully, getting back to Biden, and you look at what he was talking about Iraq, it wasn't that this was a strategic error. It wasn't that it was war crimes that were committed. No, well, it was an error in judgment. And these themes you see repeatedly. Now let's talk about how those themes work out. Number one, so many Americans don't believe that Americans could commit cruelty abroad. They don't believe it. They don't believe it because, I mean, we're American. We don't do things like that. And so there's this disconnect, kind of a mental disconnect, between what U.S. foreign policy has always been about, which really has always been pretty rough stuff, okay?
Rob,
about
what
control
you
of
just,
other countries and stuff like that. What?
What you just said resonates with what we said a couple of weeks ago, or I think it was last month, regarding the traditional Jewish community when it comes to talking the Israeli-Palestinian issue. Remember the story that you told?
The story that you told,
we are Jews and we never do these kind of things.
And it's worth repeating because it's a barrier for many American Jews admitting what the Israeli occupation and what Israeli treatment of Palestinians is about. Yeah, it's after a talk on the Middle East, and these two they were very gentle and sweet in many ways. Older men, they came to me, and we talked about my discussion, and it wasn't a bad exchange. I don't know that you could say it was friendly, but it was a real exchange. And then when I talked about the occupation, they both looked to me and they said, no, Jews couldn't do something like that. They simply didn't believe that, you know, people who are Jewish, well, in this case, Zionists in Israel, all right, but still, that they could commit the kind of war crimes, that they could impose the kind of cruel military occupation that Israel has imposed on the Palestinians. So it's like a mental block, and it's based on exceptionalism. We don't do things like that. So whether it's the Israelis or Jewish folk who use that as a pretext, or here in the United States, you know, and yet there's some, I was thinking today, Ibrahim, it's a little bit off the subject, but I was trying to understand why is it after 60, whatever it is, no, more than that, 70, what, 65 years, 75 years after the atomic bombs were dropped, there's so much opposition to admitting what has been proven again and again and again, that we didn't have to do that. And part of the reason is people cannot believe that Americans would obliterate two communities within 3 days without thinking twice. That absolutely goes against this notion of American exceptionalism, that we're the good guys.
And unfortunately, Rob, every society, yes. Last week I was talking with Yukari regarding the Japanese blind spot with regard to South Korean women. And most major, what we call colonial powers, have these blind spots when it comes to admitting that they have done genocide against the colonies that they control. Whether it's the Japanese regarding South Koreans, whether it's the Turks vis-a-vis the Armenians, whether it is the Jews vis-a-vis Palestinians, whether it's the French vis-a-vis Algerians, or American vis-a-vis the rest of the world. They are not prepared to accept, or the British in India, they are not prepared to accept that because of that exceptionalism and this arrogance, that they are capable of making such...
Doing such terrible things.
Such crimes in the world.
Could I just say that would sure. The Iraq invasion and also the result of that, where we have Abu Ghraib and then Guantanamo Bay, where it became obvious we were torturing people. And then Trump has said, and Trump, you know, during the last campaign was like, the gloves are off, we got to get tough again. It's sort of, I wonder if it's as this, I know the American exceptionalism is there, but maybe it's sort of frayed a little.
No, Jim, think about what happened with Abu Ghraib. For a short moment in time, all right, it was out in the news, very embarrassing, made people very uncomfortable. What happened to those horrible images, and really more than even the images, the whole politics of what was going on there? It disappeared, all right?
Yep.
Think about Vietnam. Think about how Vietnam is played up.
I know.
All right, so we lost 55,000, 56,000, not counting all those that committed suicide and whatever afterwards. And there's great feeling, as there should be, for Americans who died there. Do we hear any more the numbers of Vietnamese that were killed? I asked an expert on this, that a friend of mine who teaches at Regis, what was his sense of the statistic of Vietnamese casualties, and the figure that I threw out to him, because I just read it. In a mainstream journal, was that 3 million Vietnamese had died. And he looked at me, he says, no, that's real conservative. It was probably 4. So it's selective memory.
Yeah, and Agent Orange is still impacting that country. So
right. So, yeah. So, and you see this in a lot of cases, as Ibrahim said, you remember in great detail what was done to you, and you forget.
Right.
Really quickly, what it is that you've done to other people.
You talk about Agent Orange, Jim. The depleted uranium that the United States used in Iraq.
I know.
Before and after the 2003 occupation of Iraq, Iraqis are still paying. Still paying.
No, for sure.
Because of that depleted uranium in their water, in their soil, and in the deformities of children, fetus, and everything else. 1.5 million. I mean, remember, what was her name that became foreign secretary, the lady in charge, the Corbels, that she was asked.
Madeleine Albright.
Madeleine Albright. Whether it was worth it. And she said, yes, 1.5 million people, innocent people, lost their lives, not to mention anything about this dispossessed and so on. And you have this arrogance of this lady standing up and saying it was worth it. As if, and I remember early on in the 2003 war of occupation, General Power, when he was asked about Iraqi casualties, he said with absolute dismissal that we are not here to count Iraqi casualties.
That's very true. I remember that. Yep. And Fallujah, where, you know, with all the white phosphorus and depleted uranium, it's...
Exactly.
Yeah.
And who directed that?
And by the way, for both of attention, now in Iraq, they are going through records and so on to establish exactly what happened in Abu Ghraib and torture and everything else. Most of the documents that United States have it, in United States are sealed and not allowed anyone to have a look at them because they are afraid of repercussions.
And the videotapes that were destroyed by the current CIA director, can't think of her name right now, but she destroyed all those videotapes that would have implicated the torturers and so forth.
Yes. All right. And the only thing, going back to what Rob said, that this was a minor mistake, what was the excuse? Just few rotten apples.
Yeah.
Right. So... Yeah. You know, I want to come back to this whole thing about what can we expect from either Trump or Biden in terms of moving out of the morass, the hole that we're in terms of the regional big hotspot in the Middle East, if there's going to be any changes for the better. And I wish I could say, I wish there was a ray of hope here. And I, you know, look, in the long run, I suppose there is. And I don't like being pessimistic or cynical. I'm not a cynical. But I don't see it. I don't see when it comes to where this could go in the Middle East in a more positive direction, you know, given the facts that we've put forth today in this program, it looks pretty somber to me. Ibrahim, do you have any hope for some kind
of change than I do? Yeah, I would like to echo the sentiment that you expressed, Rob, because looking at it, it's a simple rule of the thumb calculation. Iran, United States, has been imposing sanction and opposing the government right from the Islamic Revolution that took place up to now. So it's nearly, 42 years or something. Despite everything that they have done, not only they have not been able to get rid or do the regime change, the regime stayed there. The only way forward is for the United States to accept and start negotiating and going back to the nuclear deal and creating peace in that region. With regard to Iraq, the United States has no alternative. Sooner or later, has to leave Iraq. And the sooner they do it, the better it is. With Syria, it's the same thing. United States, instead of leaving, they are trying to bring the Kurds of Iraq and Syria together to unite so that they become a stronger opposition to the central government. In the case of Yemen, they really need to stand up to the Saudis and others to stop it because it's a massacre. It's a genocide. With regard to Israeli-Palestinian, it's a social justice issue. You really need to resolve it where both parties can sit down in genuine negotiation. Lebanon is the same thing. Lebanese Hezbollah is part and parcel of the Lebanese community. You cannot get rid of them. Libya is the same. Turkey is the same. So the more in-depth we look at the crisis in the Middle East, whether you want to be cynical or you want to be pessimistic, I cannot be optimistic that any of these two individuals have the credential or the desire to be able to change anything within that region. I mean, I stand to be corrected, but I don't see it.
Yep. Okay, well, you...
Well, we have just a couple, about a minute left before we need to, maybe a little longer, if we can wind it up. We do have another program next week, so let's wind it up here with final thoughts.
Go ahead,
Well,
Rob.
I've already expressed it. the only thing I would add is... things are changing so fast in this region that who knows, maybe by next week they'll be the reality has shifted a little bit and we can see what direction it's going in. But it doesn't look like the doves are dominating U.S. Middle East policy.
What we really need, substantive step to be taken, not rabbit out of a hat of public relation exercise, bringing in some morons from the Middle East and taking pictures, and this is peace negotiation. It's not going to produce. There is much, has to be much more concrete and substantive.
Well, having said that, we can wind it down here.
Yeah.
Okay.
I wish we had much more optimistic point of view, but looking at these two individuals, I really don't have any hope for a peace in the world, let alone look at the 7 minutes attack on China. The coronavirus against China. This is against China. That is against China. This is not the president that wants to lead the world towards peaceful kind of negotiation and settlement.
Well, we're going to have to end it there. And again, another fine job by Ibrahim Kazrouni and Rob Prince giving us a perspective of the Middle East that we don't often hear in the corporate media. And if you would like to comment on this evening's program or any program you hear on KGNU, you can call the comment line at 303-447-9911. That's 303-447-9911. And thanks again for tuning in this evening to Hemispheres. I've been your host.